27 feet long.
Yeah, something like this. Mm-hmm. Times I always multiply by 3. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So 25 feet. I show you. I can show you the floor plan. And then I returned, and then we had the blueprint machines. You know, we had boys that made renderings. Yeah. And with colors, and at about at noontime, 10 people had worked on this project, which was well prepared. I had a folder about this size, and I calculated not too big, this is too suspicious, you know. And I came with all possible information, prices to the last penny, and committing prices and everything, and I returned to Berlin. And in the evening at about 6:30 or 7 o'clock, I rang the bell and said, "Here I am." And I had my folder and I put it in the hall on the chair there. And I walked in, and there came Albert Einstein. And this was the beginning of a long, long, long friendship later, which developed for many years. And finally, it was he who brought me to America, yeah, in this very crucial time. My animosity against Germany was so great that, for instance, during the war, I was a soldier in the French army. And this time, and you have been in the Navy, we have been at the same side. You
know? Fortunately.
Fortunately, in the same side. So and after dinner, he said, my wife told me, so she had made so many interests in Albert, would you like to sketch him out? I said, yes, in fact, I spent a little bit time on it. Can I show you some of my sketches? And I put this whole thing on the table. They have been absolutely stopped, you know. They didn't believe it. Actually, she became really suspicious. You know, who is that stranger? Yeah? How can you do this so fast? Well, I said, it's very simple. You remember when you said this? And that I made little notes and I have a good memory. And so here it is. And so Einstein was impressed. Well, that's a piece of art. And of course, he doesn't know anything about this kind of this world. You know, he doesn't know anything about building. And in the incredible up and down, and rejecting, and so on. Finally, it turned out that the offer which the city has made to Einstein was made by a city council, which was completely infested by Nazis, you know, by fascists, also by Hitler's guys already, you know. And I sensed they want to pull his leg, they want to really ridicule him and want to offer him something which is not a present, you know. And I told him this, and then one day he said, would you represent me, and I will have nothing to do with this. I'm afraid you are right. So I give you full legal authority to represent me, and you start from now on all negotiations with the city of Berlin. Which I did. And it turned out one property after the other, each time I had to reject. For instance, they gave a property which didn't even belong to the city. They found a very nice place and they wanted to make a fool out of him, you know. So I discovered this immediately, or there was another property which was really nice, except next door was a German motorboat club, and they had the whole day those motorboats running forward and back in front of this little piece of beach which he would have there, and things like this. So he finally became sick and tired of it, and he said he wrote a letter to the city. He rejects the present, and they should forget about it. And then later, these details I don't have to say. He called me and said, "I decided to build it myself. I want you to build my house." He was so in this whole thing, and this took many months, you know. About 6-8 months, and so I built his house, which is not a real, which was messed up by such requirements. He said, "I love French windows, you know, they go down to the floor, and I like shutters, I like a roof, you know, and all those horrible things, and which, but I could not resist, you know, I did this. And this was the end of the time in which I felt I'm now leaving that company. When I had this job, you know, I was considered I cannot do better than this, and whatever buildings may be built, this is it. And so I left the company, and I was, as it later turned out, I was absolutely right. It was the best possible time, because it was about 2 years, it was 1929, I believe, yeah, 28 or 29, something like this. And then 30, you know, the 33, Hitler. So I went back to Berlin, and then I had a good fortune. I built a big brick house, yeah, and the brick construction, for a doctor, and had some other job, and then again there was nothing left. Suddenly I was staying there exactly where I was before, no money, nothing to live on, no chance to get anything, but just disaster. And in this early time I loved very much to read books like anybody else, but not only to read them but to have them too. So there was a book dealer. He was the salesman from books. He always said, my dear young friend, you know, you have a bright future, you don't have to pay, we can wait, just say any book you want to have, we give it to you. Yeah. And then when you are established, then you pay. So I believed this too, and I had marvelous library in the age of 26 or 27, you know, all very selected items. And then he, but a year or two later, he began to pressure me. And this was just unfortunate at the time in which there was absolutely nothing anymore. And then he sent me letters, so if I don't pay, then they will sue me. And this would mean bankruptcy, and this is in Germany, then you are finished, you know. It's not like here when you say you have one bankruptcy, you pay the debts some way or the other, and then you go on again, you know. So I was rather in a terrible situation, and one day I get so scared, I said I have to leave town. And I tell you all this because the real fear and the pressure, you know, there is no way out. And I have to leave town and don't know where to go. So I wrapped everything together. And I suddenly discovered I had already hundreds of photographs of buildings which I have built. All wooden structures, very few also brick structures and such things. And there was an architectural magazine, Wasmuth. Wasmuth is this name?
Ja, das stimmt.
The cultural Wasmuth, Wasmuth's publishing house, or Wasmuth's Monatshefte für Baukunst, also the best European magazine. For a long time, for instance, I had the feeling that the best European magazine was Architectural Review in London. Yeah, you know this. And this was before, was this Wasmuth's monthly for Baukunst, this as the art of building. Yeah, mm-hmm. something like this. But this is. I mean, every historian knows that magazine. And I wanted to go to them, and I wanted in the last split of it. Of complete desperation, wanted to offer them to make a publication of those in their magazine, you know, of my work, which I was very critical of. Each time when I built a house, and I said I will never do that again, you know, and so on. And so the publisher to whom I went also forced myself in there. He said, I have very little time, what do you want? And I said, I wanted to ask you if you're interested in publishing my material. And he said, what are you? Are you employed? I said, no, I'm not employed. I'm self-employed. And what do you have? And I had an envelope, so you know, this yellow envelope, and the photos have been glossy. Yeah, and so I tried to open it, this was unintentionally, and it slid out over the whole table, so you could see with one look many, many things at once. And said, they are, of course, all wooden structures. I apologize, you know, but I did other things too. And he said, did you do this? Yes, I said. And is this all wooden structures? Is this named Werner Hegemann? Does this ring a bell? Werner Hegemann was a very important man. H-E-G-E-M-E-N. He was, or double N, yeah. He was a correspondent. He was an architect who lived in New York. And he was a correspondent to this magazine in Berlin, and he reported about the situation in America. Yeah. And he wrote and he said, this, Mr. Hegemann, just wrote me a letter and he said, we should, for heaven's sake, bring something about wood construction, which in America is the absolute dominating system of construction, you know. They don't build steel and concrete, as many people think. There's only 5% and 95% is wooden construction. But we don't have it, but here it is. Said, sit down, you smoke a cigar, just a minute, I come back. And he talked with his assistants, you know, with his staff there about it, and they came all in, and he said to me, do you have already a luncheon appointment? I will never forget. I haven't had a luncheon for a week, I believe. And I said, I tell you, it's a very bad time right now. I think it was February. Yeah? Nobody publishes books in the summertime. And I thought, this man is crazy. You know, I didn't talk about a book. I want to have an article, we get 200 marks, pay greatest part of my debts, have few days to live, and then we see what happened. So he said, but we are so interested, we decided we want to make it. Can you believe this? He talked to me as if he wanted to make a book, and I talked to him as if I would be in heaven if he would print my stuff in his magazine, 3 or 4 pages. Yeah. And I've never in my life published anything. I was against this. I have a certain... No, that is, I don't want to talk now about. So he said, when can we make a contract? I said, as soon as possible. Can you call your lawyer? I said, I have no lawyer. I have never had a lawyer. Oh, and have, I said, Mr. Wasmut, I have complete confidence. If you want to make a book, you make a book and you give me, I accept any contract. If it is a bad contract, I will be so disappointed, I think I will write a bad book. If it is a good contract, I make a good book. This is, I said, in the age of, how old I was, 28 or 27 years old. And to make the long story short, we went to an incredible restaurant which I never dreamed about to be inside, you know. And when we returned, the lawyer was waiting. I walked out of this place with a contract, with a big red seal, and my debts to this. This publishing house was also had a bookstore. Those have been the people who had my debts, and the debts have been cancelled, and I had a check of 1,000 mark in my pocket. This was about my life. So I published a book in the age of 28. Yeah. You have never seen that, no? Would you like to see it?
Yes, I would.
I can bring it in a few minutes. let me finish because it takes too much time. It's not, does not go into your questions, you know. And then I made the book. The book was an instant success. It was the first time that somebody wrote about timber construction, not as a cheap barrack building or so, but as a decent means of building houses. And I had a collection of photographs, of course, collected already, and so on. So it was a good success. But then came bad times again. I'm the type of money spender, you know. When I have $10 in my pocket, then I certainly spend $11, you know, you can be sure. And so a short time after, the same situation existed. And in we have 1931 or 32, I believe. And the first year was fine, I was great, you know. And then I got immediately a contract to write a book about, not about a book, there was an architectural magazine, Bauwelt, you know this one?
Yes.
It's a very, very important one. And I got the whole special issue about wooden construction, which I think I still have one copy. And then do I have a copy? I have to see. No, I don't think so, don't have it. And there came the summer of 1932. This was a crucial summer, the next one. And I was in Berlin. No money. Berlin boiling hot. So hot that the streets are covered, have been covered with asphalt during this time. You know, the asphalt melts. When you step on this asphalt, you see your imprint. This was about the climate. And I walked one day to the streets and I met some guy who said, "Conrad, what are you doing in Berlin?" I said, "Well, where shall I go?" He said, "You should be on the beaches in the Baltic Sea, you know." Yes, I said, "You can do this." "I can't, you know." And then, "Why don't you go to Rome?" I said, "What is, are you crazy?" "Well," I said, "there's the German, the academy, there's a Prix de Rome. You should have the Prix de Rome." And I said, "Well, what is the Prix de Rome?" And he said, "Well, go in this building there." I just, and this is all real, you know. The coincidence just happened to go in the street where some ministry is, the culture, Ministry of Culture, yeah, and of Germany. So you ask to this man there who is in charge of the Prix de Rome. So I walked up there. He said, "I'm going here and sit in this cafe and I buy you coffee when you come back and you tell me what this man said." I walked up and said, "Can I talk to this Mr. So-and-so?" "Well, you have an appointment?" "No." And in this moment the door opens and that man I wanted to see came out and he turned around and asked me what I want. I said, "I want to have some information about the German Academy in Rome, the Prix de Rome." I said, "Are you a student?" "No." I said, "Are you employed?" "No." I said, "I am self-employed." "Oh, you're out of work." "Well," I said, "have you ever built a building?" "Oh, yes." I said, "Can you show me one?" I said, "If you wait a few minutes, I can do so." He said, "Okay, I will wait. I have to leave in a half an hour, so you come quickly back." He didn't ask me where I went. I rushed down across the street. Where there was a bookstore, and I was sure they would have my book about wooden house construction. You know, I rushed there and said, "Can you give me the book? My name is Conrad Wachsmann." And they gave it to me. And I had nothing to pay, only to sign a paper. And I rushed up and I showed him the book. That is, of course, a good advertising, you know. And then he said, "Do you have any recommendation?" I said, "Yes, I have my professor is Hans Pelz." "You know Hans Pelz?" "Oh, yes." And he picked up the telephone and called Hans Pelz. Pelz was there. And he shouted in the telephone, this was his manner, you know, he said, you guys, we taxpayers, have to pay you instead. You surely you have to send that man to Rome, you know, and so on. To make that long story short, I got to Priederholm. Then I left, could leave Germany. This was the end journey in Germany, basically. Then I went to Rome, and as soon as I was there, about half a year, as I had a pretty Roman, lived there like a king, suddenly. And I had a Hitler camp, yeah, so I didn't return anymore. And the way to Rome was also some fantastic story, which does not belong in this, but I just want to indicate it. For instance, I traveled from the Swiss border to Rome in 2.5 months. I had studied the maps and I went to everything to the first from Milan, Bergamo, Vicenza to Verona, Vicenza to Venice, and then to Bologna, and then to the Toscana and Umbria and Florence and Siena and everything, and Assisi and Perugia. As you mentioned it, I saw them, and I arrived instead in October and in December in Rome, yeah. And but then it became very unpleasant because it turned out that two of the people there in Rome have been, of course, already belonged to this new regime. You know, I'm terrible allergic to this kind, to this world. Yeah, and when Hitler came to power, the next day I resigned. I didn't want to have anything to do with Germany anymore. And this whole resentment came out again, you know, so deeply. And I moved into some furnished room there in Rome, and not knowing what to do now. Then I found a guy who on the street, who was a Spanish painter whom I have known, and he said, "I'm leaving tomorrow for Spain, would you like to come with me?" "Yes, I would like, but I have no money. And if you give me a chance, I may have something, because I have a camera and I can sell it, and then I come to Spain, I have nothing to do." So I went to Spain, I went to Granada. Granada, the city planner of Granada, was a man who spoke German, and he had studied at the Bauhaus. Yeah. And I lived 1 year in Granada. Incredible.
Had you known any of the Italian constructivists while you were in Italy? Nervi, Morandi?
Nervi became later, yeah, surely. But this was not at this time. No, no. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about 1933.
Well, remember that Nervi had been a member of a group of Italians who published a functionalist manifesto.
Oh, surely.
Early in the 20s.
Yeah, surely. But this. First of all, I couldn't read Italian. I didn't speak Italian. Mm-hmm. I couldn't. I spoke bad German. I never really learned the sophisticated language of intellectuals. You know. Then I lived in Italy under very sheltered circumstances, some palatial. Kind of palace, you know, which all the French Academy, the American Academy, the German Academy can imagine. So I had no contact whatsoever at this time with any German, any Italian architect. This came all this much, much later. So I left for Spain. I lived in Spain, and then again there came a fascist general, Franco, you know, what is this? Di Rivera, yeah. He was a foreigner from Franco, yeah. I forgot his first name. And my friend, the city planner of Granada, was a socialist, yeah. And so we had to run away, and so I had to run away, and I ended up in the Provence, in the south of France, in Aix-en-Provence, where I had friends, wherever I went, it was the same thing. But they lived in the country, and I lived there, and then I And then it turned out, now where to go from here? I had a little bit of money in the meantime, for a few weeks, you know, something like this. And then I corresponded with Rome, and finally I returned to Rome because I had a chance to find some work in Rome. And then I lived a few years in Rome, ups and downs, and finally really get a few buildings built there. And then came 1938, that Hitler came to Rome, I came again into, they put me in jail for weeks, and the possibility existed, as they did in many other instances, to ship the people to Germany, yeah, and then the gas chambers. Yeah. And so but I survived this one. Then clandestinely I walked over the border without papers into France, near Nice, you know, and Menton, yeah, this. And so I was in France. From there I still had enough money to go to Paris. And I had a girlfriend, she went with me, and she had a little sewing machine, which I carried with my hand, you know, a hand sewing machine. Yeah. And we went, we lived in an incredible place, sous les toits de Paris, yeah, in Rue Vaugirard, near the Luxembourg, yeah. And she made sometimes a prepared a dress for some other refugees, and we had an incredible life there. Then we have been forced to leave Paris, because the Germans had already infiltrated France before the war, so much that the French police did exactly what the Germans wanted them to do. So I went to Grenoble. There was a governor who had been told would was in favor of refugees, and there I got a carte d'identité, yeah, which is the most important paper to survive in France. And from then on I went to Vins, and do you know the Provence there?
Yes, yes.
Vins, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Saint Paul de Vins, and this, mm-hmm. and then came the war, and I came into concentration or internment camp, and there immediately I hit the other jackpot. I became Monsieur l'Architecte du Camp. Mm-hmm. I was the architect of the camp, and I had to organize beds and the shelters for the mid drawings for the layout of this camp, and then suddenly there was an intervention. Einstein, whom I had a nice correspondence with him, and he has known my situation. And he had sent me every month $10. Yeah? And I lived with this girl in the south of France in the sheep stable, which was built from rocks into there was a hillside, and there was sticked out at the corner, and there had been two other walls, so this was a space where they kept their sheep. This was empty, and we lived there for about a year and a half on $10 a month, which is very hard to do for two people, yeah. But we survived, and then finally some people became interested in my case, and I have been accepted in the French army. I had three choices: to go to the French Legion, to Africa, or in the French army, or to declare myself prisoner of war in favor of the Germans, you know. And I have chosen the army, even if they said, if you ever would be caught, then you will be shot, of course, immediately. Yeah. I said, that's okay with me, that I will not be caught. And I wasn't. And from there on, after the defeat of Germany, I was in some artillery regiment. We never saw a real battle, you know. This whole thing was a phony war, which most people don't know. The war in France was actually not a war. This was all arranged. The whole French officer corps, yeah, was already pro-Nazi. Yeah. And And so I, at the very end, after the defeat, my girlfriend, she has been arrested. She came to a woman's camp in Pyrenees, and when I was demobilized from the French army, I walked back to the south of France, and then she also managed to hitchhike back to the same place, and then we met again, and then finally the Jewish refugee committee, they gave us tickets and we arrived in America. An incredible trip. It was a Spanish boat which we had been transported from France to Spain to Sevilla, and this was a kind of river boat, you know, at 5,000 tons boat, and we had 1,200 passengers on this boat, which has accommodation for 8 people, and they put the front bunk, the front hole was for men and the back hole was for women, and they have bunk beds 3 on top of each other. And we traveled 22 days from Seville via Lisbon to New York. 22 days in this boat. And nights people have been, they died, they have been thrown overboard. And in the daytime we have been sitting on this boat. So crowded that when people died, they couldn't fall down. They have been squeezed in between others. So then, and America was a beautiful story, this I don't have to say. So this was my beginning. And you have to remember all the time, you know, and sometimes certain, what is, vacuums or hollow spots. This I had to suffer all my life, and my lack of education, and my lack of understanding of teachers, the circumstances that my father died too early, and this emotional handicap I had at this time, and be incapable to learn. You know.
And you got to the United States in what year, Conrad? 48?
No, much, much earlier. September 12, 1941. I was so poor that they put me in some refugee hotel, you know, we landed in Brooklyn, we have been brought to the hotel in 87th Street, on the west side, and the next day I had to go to a refugee committee to collect the first $10, and then I walked down from 87th Street to 42nd Street, because I haven't had a nickel for the subway. The subway cost a nickel at this time. And then I got $10. Then I sent a postcard to Gropius. I said, I'm arrived here. Oh, I forget the story. Gropius I have known for many years. Huh? And he immediately...
Gropius was at Harvard then.
Gropius was at Harvard, lived in Lincoln. He has this nice white house there, you know. He said, you come immediately here. And he sent me a check for which I could cash immediately to buy a ticket, and I went to Boston to Back Bay Station. He was standing there, picked me up, drove me with his car in this incredible, elegant and beautiful house, which was so silent, and I was sitting in the evening on the dining table, Walter Gropius, Isa Gropius, and Artie Gropius, the daughter, which actually has something to do with that story, because she was a student at Black Mountain College, and myself, sitting as if nothing did happen. Perfect silence, elegance, white carpet, the spotlight in the ceiling illuminating the round table designed by Mori Linagi. All this unreal business, you know, which so crazy as it can be. Yeah. So, and then one year later, 12th September 1942, I was executive vice president of a corporation, so-called General Panel Corporation. You know, I designed a system for prefabricated houses at this time. And And from then on, everything went beautiful, yeah? Well, the next disaster started, yeah? Mm-hmm. But it's a difference.
Well, why don't we stop then?
Yeah, we stop here.